Good morning, CKMS listeners. It is Paul Schultz, and you are listening to CKMS Radio 102.7 Community Radio here in Waterloo, waterloo.ca. And this morning, we're having to do things a little bit differently due to the COVID-19. We are with Tom Nunn this morning, and we are remote. He's in his home office, and I am in mine, and we are relying on technology here to conduct this quick little interview with Tom and play some of his original music as well as some cover songs. Tom Nunn is a resident of Kitchener-Waterloo. He in Kitchener, as a matter of fact, he grew up in Norfolk County and was tremendously influenced with bluegrass music down there. And we're glad to be able to have this conversation with Tom, play some of his music, get some of the stories from his original works, as well as some of the stories as he toured the Great Lakes and parts and places across Canada, touring with bands, playing bluegrass music at bluegrass festivals throughout Ontario and, again, parts of Canada, as mentioned. And Tom, welcome to CKMS Radio, and it's a pleasure to have you here, and thank you for doing this.
Oh, great to talk to you, Paul. It's great to always talk to you anytime, and this is always a lot of fun, so we'll get right into it here.
You bet. It's been a long time. It's great that we reached out and you accepted this invitation to do this with me. Grew up in Norfolk County, Tom. Long legacy of bluegrass music in your family. I've read some of the posts your music and your words and your stories on Facebook. Glad I reached out to have you share them with our listening audience. Tell me about your experience of growing up in Norfolk County. I know that your dad was a musician and a big family and a lot of music in the house. Tell me how that all went in the Nunn's home.
Well, it's a crazy story, Paul, because it's kind of like a lot of the families down east.
Yeah.
I have pictures of some of my aunts holding their instruments in the 1920s. A fiddle and a banjo, that kind of thing. And our grandfather played. And so the thing was when he was playing, he played house parties and things around Norfolk County. When my father was 11, he started to play rhythm guitar with my grandfather at these house parties. And so you fast forward to when I'm growing up, I was on stage when I was 12 years old in my dad's dance band playing at weddings every weekend.
Yeah, terrific.
Playing electric bass. And so, but they were fiddle players, a lot of fiddle players, a lot of exposure. And my dad had these two big floor radios that he would pull in the signals, and that's where they got into the bluegrass. They could hear Bill Monroe back in the 40s and Ralph Stanley, all these great guys broadcasting from Kentucky and Virginia. And he would teach his brothers how to play, but then he started to teach his brothers-in-law how to play. And there are like 49 first cousins on that side of the family, and there's 40 on my dad's side. So everybody just grew up in about a 6-mile, 10-mile radius playing music every weekend, right?
Yeah.
So they had a band back in the 40s and 50s called the Dusty Acre Boys down in Norfolk County. It was the Tobacco Belt, right? So
yeah.
In the 30s, there was a lot of dust storms, you know, blowing around and things like that.
So sure.
That was the thing. And so there was my dad, my Uncle Lee, Uncle Bill, Uncle Harry. Like, they were all playing at these old dance halls. And a really interesting way to grow up and just being exposed to music all the time. And we just naturally listened to all kinds of music. So I was listening to, you know, guys like The Cream and Eric Clapton and Bruce on the rock side, but then being exposed to all this other folk music and bluegrass music and country music. And
oh, yeah. Just a great experience to grow up with that kind of music around.
Yep. And down the road was hilarious. Like all of our cousins, we all played baseball and hockey and stuff, but then we go sit in somebody's kitchen and pick music for hours, right? And, well, what have you learned this week? And off we'd go. And that was just a natural thing to do. So, but it did come from our parents' generation and even the generation before that, which is really strange.
So music started back with your great-grandfather.
Yeah, well, he was a fiddle player as well. And so my grandfather was the only, like, I remember him playing when I was a kid. I used to tuck the thing in his elbow, sit there with this pipe going, and he'd be sawing away on his elbow. But he could play hundreds of fiddle tunes, and my dad was the same way, right? He grew up learning from my grandfather and from his aunt, his older sister, who was... Anyway, it's very interesting.
Yeah, very interesting. How come... What part of Norfolk County? What part were you raised?
We were about 15 miles north of Long Point, up towards Langton area.
Okay.
And so it's very, very rural area. We were just on a small plot there, and all of us kind of lived right around each other, right? Like my grandparents on the Schott side were like a half a mile away. My grandparents on the Nunn side were a half mile away. A friend of mine who actually was a fellow who worked at the record, a guy named a really great arts writer, Rob Breed, he used to work in Simcoe. He used to work in Simcoe after I was at the Simcoe Reformer, and he said, yeah, it's kind of like the Appalachia of Canada down there. Everybody knows each mm-hmm. other. Many are related, and there's music everywhere, right? So
yeah,
beautiful place to live.
And what is it with the fiddles down in Norfolk? Anytime I go to any bluegrass festival or country festival in the Tillsonburg area, Port Dover, anywhere south of Simcoe County, there's a tremendous amount of fiddle players.
And well, I think it's you'll see it in pockets all over Canada, right? That there are people.
Yeah, yeah.
People will if there's a good fiddle player, and this is what I found from watching my father and my grandfather, is they influence other people to play. And suddenly, like a really one of the greatest fiddle players in the family is a fellow named Darren Schott. And he started playing mandolin when he was 10, but then he goes into fiddle and it's like, okay, he can play anything. And that's the challenge. I mean, some of these guys like Shane Cook, outrageous fiddle player. Like there are some great fiddle players in various parts of Ontario. Down east, it's the same thing. You have generations of fiddle players, like the McMasters, the whole influence of people who can play suddenly show others how to play. We have three boys and they say the same thing. They kind of grew up going to bluegrass festivals with us, with our band.
Mm-hmm.
I used to think they probably hated that. I thought they might not even enjoy that, but they loved it. They say now that that's where they learned how to play. That's where they learned how to jump off the cliff and just do it.
Yeah.
And suddenly music is happening, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Immerse yourself in it.
And it can be around. Just get right into it. Jump off that cliff and go.
Yeah, you bet. And you you just mentioned 12 years old was your first performance?
I was on stage when I was 12. Yeah.
Very good. Very, very neat.
And my brother was in that band and he was on stage when he was 14 and he was a drummer. So he was on stage playing drums at 14. I come along and start playing at 12 and my dad's on the other end of the stage and it's like, okay.
Yeah. Oh yeah. It would be born in a family of musicians, long generations of musicians. It was just a natural step for you to be out on that stage at a young age. Yeah, obviously been performing in kitchens. You had experience with music before you got to that stage, and you were ready to go at 10, at 12 years old. That's awesome.
Yeah, it was fun.
What? How old were you when you got serious about it and said, "Hey, like, why don't I get a band together and really seriously focus on bluegrass music or whatever type of music you were doing at that young age?"
It was funny because I was so busy in my father's wedding band that I didn't really get into a bluegrass band until I was in first year university at Western. And I tied into a bunch of guys from the Elmer area. And I was mm-hmm. playing in both bands at the same time for a while, which is really weird. You go from playing polkas and waltzes and tangos at a wedding to playing in a bar or at some festival with a bunch of guys and you're doing all kinds of bluegrass, hard driving bluegrass music, right?
Right.
And that was a great experience. And then kind of, it fell off the radar for a long time. I still played at home and everything, but I mean, I ended up in newspapers for 20 years at 5 different newspapers, and that became my career. And the music was always a hobby. But in the 90s, I'm back in Ontario at the record, and suddenly a bunch of guys, I ran into them, and it was a fiddle player, John Dare from Kitchener, who played like my dad. And my dad had passed in 1989. He had a battle with cancer. Anyway, he had passed, and I just ran into John out in Wellesley and St. Clements there area out there and got playing with him one afternoon in one of the open stage things. And right away, Norm Tellier and all these other bluegrass guys said, "Whoa, where'd this guy come from?" So anyway, I ended up in their band for about 10 years, and we had a good time.
What was the name of that band?
that band was called Northern City Limits, and we played through the 90s, and we played a lot of mainly festivals and soft seat concerts instead of, we didn't like playing in bars because it's just too crazy.
Sure.
So we ended up playing a lot of festivals and a lot in the United States, Indiana, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania, New York, and would gravitate towards, and we were very, for some reason, I think because we didn't sound like the Nashville or the Southern bluegrass guys.
Yeah.
Our voices are softer.
Sure.
I mean, we played the same instruments, but we sounded a little different. And because we were from outside of the States, we just kept on going back. And so that we had to, you know, make sure we had all the visas and contracts and everything in place. But it was a lot of fun down there. And we still have friends to this day down there. We did a couple of recordings and just had a blast doing it, mainly on weekends.
Yeah, that's...
You know, because we all had day jobs, so it was like
all day jobs, getting in vehicles and traveling around the Great Lakes playing bluegrass music on the weekends. That's a busy time and a busy life, but a lot of fun.
A lot of fun, and we take our families with us a lot of the times.
For sure. I see it even to this day. When I go to a bluegrass festival. The entertainers are very accommodating. They're out there to shake your hands, to say hi, and share their music experience with you more than any other genre of music.
I think so.
When you go to a bluegrass festival, it's like going home. It's like you're gonna meet a new family or a member of your family at that bluegrass festival.
It really
festival.
Is. I mean, those people are lifelong friends too. One of my favorite stories we had. We played the Havelock Festival down near Peterborough. It's one of the biggest ones, right? And we were on stage, and you know, we always joked that we were the token bluegrass band there. Although, you know, there was mainly a country event, but Loretta Lynn was Hank Williams III, Blue Rodeo, Prairie Oyster, Valdi, Murray McLaughlin. Like, it was a great lineup, and here we are.
Great right? lineup.
So we come off the stage, and there's like 6,000 or 7,000 people watching us, right? And I'm thinking, this is crazy. So we come off the stage, and we're laughing about it. And one of the organizers said, well, what are you guys doing? We said, oh, we're just sort of chilling out. They said, well, we need you over at the autograph tent. I said,
sure.
Autograph tent? What's that about? He says, hey, look at the lineup. We stood there and signed autographs for an hour and a half, and I mean, it was crazy. It just was. That was the only place that really happened, but it was nice to meet people and play that kind of music, because it's, I don't know, there's an energy to it that I've always loved, and so there was a mixture of fiddle tunes and mandolin tunes and banjo tunes, and we would mix it up. We did gospel. We did all kinds of weird stuff. We even did some Grateful Dead and Beatles tunes and things like that. So it was a lot of fun.
Well, you just mentioned a gospel tune, and due to COVID-19, we're all sequestered in our homes and locked down. I've been checking out your Facebook page daily. There's some great videos you are putting up, Tom, and a great description of your experience introducing the song. I've always been a fan of gospel music, and as we talk about that, I know that there was one song that hit me one glorious day.
Right.
Tell me a little bit about that song. Love to play that for our listening audience here on CKMS Radio. Tell us a little bit about that story.
Well, that one was one I wrote. It was actually on a Canada Day, July 1st. And it was one of these mornings you get up and you look out and there's not a bloody cloud in the sky anywhere. It was a great morning. And so that idea in my head was, I mean, that was the way I was thinking. It's just one glorious day, right? So I sat down and literally wrote out those lyrics in a very short period, just line after line. And took it to the guys in the band. I said, here's what I think this could go like. And they literally played it that night, almost exactly the way it sounds on the recording. And we did this, that particular song was recorded at Rick Hutt's studio here at Cedar Tree Kitchen.
Uh-huh.
And Rick is a spectacular engineer and just knows what the sound should be like. But that song was our leadoff song on that, on our second CD, and it showed up. It was on a compilation disc for the Ontario Arts Council. And I think our song was right before Ron Hines' Sunny Stream tune on that SNIS. And then that was on one of the plowing matches, used it as, you know, one of their recordings to promote the plowing match. And it's really funny. We played that all over the place. And my favorite thing someone said to me was down in Indiana, we played it. And a woman came up to me after we came off the stage and said, that song on that, she had a cassette tape version of it. She said, that song in that cassette, I said, I'm going to just wear that cassette out, because I play that song every morning going to work. She said, it's such a positive message. And I thought, well, that's what it's all about, right? It's just being able to have that influence, and somebody hears something and goes, that's how I feel.
Yeah, music it's interpreted a lot of ways, and when it connects with you, it feels like your own personal experience. What a great story. Let's listen to One Glorious Day right now, an original song written by Tom Nunn, and enjoy One Glorious Day.
One glorious day, no cloud will break it. One glorious day, no one will shake it. Clear blue sky, no sign of sorrow. Won't need tomorrow, one glorious day. Dawn is rising, light sifting through the trees. You're there to greet me once again. Your smile, the sun I need, with you by my side. It's all I can ask for. No one can take away this glorious day. No cloud can break it. This glorious day, no one can shake it. Clear blue sky, no sign of sorrow. Won't need tomorrow. Glorious day. No end inside in the deep blue distance. It lifts us up and holds high. No sign of doubt, pain, or sorrow. Just cloudless heaven in that deep blue sky. This glorious day, no cloud can break it. This glorious day, no one can shake it. Clear blue sky, no sign of sorrow. Only tomorrow, this glorious day. This glorious day, no cloud can break it. This glorious day, no one can shake it. Clear blue sky, no sign of sorrow. Won't need tomorrow, this glorious day. Won't need tomorrow, this glorious day.
We're back after listening to One Glorious Day. Tom, that is a fantastic song, bluegrass energy. How long have you been writing songs?
Oh, man, I'm trying to think of how long it's been. It's got to be back into the 60s. I was trying to do things, but I've written instrumentals, I've written things like that, but it's been funny how it comes about. I mean, everyone is different. It's, for me, I don't write that many that they're all the same. I don't, you know, it's not like writing news stories every day where you get it into a rhythm.
Sure.
With music, it's always been a hobby, a sideline, and it's something that I sit down and I almost feel like I need that inspiration, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it's funny how these things come about. But I've been tootling around, and a lot of us in the family have done it, written different music, and it's usually about something we relate to, right? I've done instrumentals about a creek down the road. I've done instrumentals, you know, about my Uncle Bill's barn. I've done stuff like this.
Yeah, sure.
And actually, that's been some of the fun. We were talking about Facebook and things, and I really hadn't done much with music on Facebook at all
until
just this COVID thing happened. And it was like, I was not even interested in doing it. And one of my friends from Saskatchewan, I'd used to play music with, and we played a lot in the West. He said, come on, get off your duff there and do something.
Yeah.
What else are you doing around the house?
Yeah, that's generally so, the cliche now, right? It's we're sitting on our hands anyway. We might as well present the music.
That's right. So I thought he's making a good point here. So I thought, it won't take me long to gather some of
this
stuff or sit down and record it. And so I started doing that, and the reaction was surprising. I just was not expecting people to be like, a lot of times, you know, up until this happened, people would not even sit and listen to a video of somebody playing music or whatever. Now it seems like everyone's online and everybody's engaging, right?
Yeah, yeah. Advertise a watch party, and you're going to have 30, 40 people. And that's the neatest thing about this. I had the conversation with a friend of mine probably 3 weeks before the COVID hit, and we talked about musicians posting their original compositions or music that they do on the internet, on Facebook. And there was almost a stigma to it. And now that COVID hit, here we're all doing it. And it's a fantastic way to connect with old friends. It's a fantastic way to connect because we all need music. And it's a great way to sit down with the family and enjoy a friend playing his music in your living room. And you get a front row seat to it.
It really is.
So yeah. It's really changed the direction of it. I mean, I know that there's a lot of us sitting at home. My co-host, Steve Todd, that does opposite Monday mornings than I do here on CKMS Radio. He's done a few watch parties, posted a few of a bunch of his songs. Other friends, I'm sure a lot of your friends are doing the same thing. And it's a good thing to see. It's a great way to connect and stay in touch with people and reach out during these tough times. So, yeah, we'll keep it up, and I know you will too. And it's a good thing to check in on Tom Nunn every morning to see what he's up to. and you mentioned earlier that you've been with five newspapers across Canada. That was your career. You are a media consultant now, Tom. Excuse me, you're a media consultant.
Yes, yeah, I was. Some people in town here might remember the days I was at the Record as a business reporter for about 15 years. But before that, I was in Saskatchewan at the Regina Leader Post, and down in Simcoe, Ontario, at the Reformer, and Delhi, and Exeter. Anyway, in 1998, Manulife hired me to be their head of the public affairs and media relations, and so I did that for about 12 years. And then in 2011, I set up my own consulting business, and I've been doing that as a thing ever since. So music still happens, though. Still get to.
Well, and that's the focus on CKMS Radio. We're on this show, Musicians FAQ. But obviously, we love to talk to musicians here in the community. When they share their music here in the community, but you know, you've been other places in Canada, and you've been obviously around this area, Delhi, Simcoe. Great to have you settle in Kitchener. How long have you been here?
Since 1984. So it's
you've been quite a while.
Pretty good run, yes. So it's a great town for music. I'll tell you, it's just so many great musicians around. I mean, you mentioned a few already. I mean, Steve Todd and those guys, and I mean there are so many. We played many times at the Millrace Festival. Probably, I think I've been there maybe six, seven different times.
Yeah,
we played it with the bluegrass band, but I also have played with different people around the area, and it's just had been a really nice festival. Like, it went through, I guess, 26 years. It just wrapped up last year.
Yeah, but that was too bad to see that go.
Too bad to see that, but you know, you've got, and then Hillside and Guelph, just a lot of musicians around this area. That's what I love. And different types of music as well, like just a really good mix of Celtic and folk and, you know, all kinds of different influences.
You know, every time I talk to a musician or do an episode here on Musicians FAQ, the conversation always comes up about how blessed we are with talent in the Waterloo region. Steve Todd, I listened to one of his interviews with a gentleman by the name of Dennis Scheer. Do you know Dennis Scheer? A great writer, more the commercial, or the country music, writes a lot of country music. Talked to Dennis last week on Monday morning, and the stories he was able to tell about Cedar Tree and his experience with Jason Berry and Jamie Warnes, all of these musicians in KW. I don't know whether it's the fact that we're an hour away from the airport and whenever somebody needs to jump on a plane to do a concert somewhere, but they seem to we seem to be rich in this area with musicians, and always it was a pleasure to get out to Millrace and see you play with Norm Tellier. There was another gentleman. It was a trio that used to play with.
Jeff Summers is. We've played with Jeff Summers as well a few times. I played with Lyle Friesen from Waterloo here. Uh-huh. He's a great mandolin player. And just it would depend on just the combination they were looking for or whatever sound was happening. And we had quite a relationship with Brad McEwen was the organizer there, and so we played there quite a few times. And some of my favorite experiences were we played all over the place, but that event we were so lucky to be there at some very unique times, right? I remember one Millrace, we were on the main stage and it just started to pour, so we raced down the street to the theater, which was the backup venue. The sound system wasn't up, there was nothing ready. We walked in, people were already running in because it's pouring rain, and we just walked to the edge of the stage and did the entire set acoustically on the edge of the stage while the sound guys set up the speakers and everything around us to get ready for the next one. Loved that. And so the same thing sort of happened to us. We were in Michigan playing a festival down there, and suddenly the power went right in the middle of our set. Everything just died. So we all looked at each other and thought, oh, we've done this before. Yeah. So we walk off the stage down into the crowd, and then people in the crowd just naturally surrounded us. And we played the whole rest of the set, standing down in the crowd, and people loved that we just picked it up and went with it, right?
And yeah, you bet.
Yeah, it was great.
Have you ever have you had a chance to see the Western Swing Authority?
Oh, Shane and Ozzy, yeah, they're an awesome
band. Gousset, Ed Ringwald, yes. Stacey Lee.
They are an awesome band. So
awesome band.
Highly recommend those guys.
Yeah, highly recommend that. And they do not a set, but a couple of songs where they come off the stage, and you get that acoustic, raw, you know, music experience. And I know what you're talking about with that presentation. That's it's always nice to listen to bluegrass music in its raw form.
Yeah, and Shane is one of the best fiddle players anywhere. I tell you, that guy has so much energy; it's crazy.
Yeah, you know, I always. So And Stacey, for people that don't know, Shane and Stacey are a married couple here in Waterloo. That Shane started a band called the Western Swing Authority, and I think Tom would agree. If you get a chance to see the Western Swing Authority, get out and see them. They are a cast of multi-talented musicians, and they will entertain you for the evening and beyond. You will become a fan. Original music. Let's get back to some of your original music. Talk about that song, Blue Mold Blues. Original tune by Tom Noone.
Well, we were talking about songwriting, and this is probably the weirdest one I've had the fortune of running into. There's myself, but three other guys actually helped write this. And the three other guys have no music background whatsoever. They were news reporters sitting down in the Norfolk County area. And they were sitting there, and it was 1979. Blue mold was devastating the tobacco crop.
Ah,
and then a tornado went through and hit Woodstock and Vanessa and Waterford and did all kinds of damage down in the tobacco belt. And these guys, being news guys, are sitting there thinking, well, this has the makings of a blues number, right? So they just started writing out the lyrics. And they wrote the lyrics in an afternoon. They gave me a shout and said, hey, we've got these lyrics. Can you put some music to it? And so, I mean, I might have changed a couple words, but it was pretty well there. And, you know, made it work. And it's a pretty good news blues number, I think, and it's actually one of the more popular ones. I just stuck that up on Facebook a few weeks back, and I could not get over the reaction. It was like, especially down in Norfolk, people who hadn't heard it before thought it was, it was getting shared all over the place, right? And, I don't know, 1,200 people.
That is neat.
Looking at it, and yeah, it's pretty crazy, and a lot of people commenting on it, thinking, you know, and the funny thing, twist there was, I actually covered the damage from that tornado as well. I was up in an airplane taking photos from this airplane the next morning after the tornado, and I was writing the story for the front page of the Simcoe Reformer, and all the pictures, you know, that I took in this airplane. As a reporter, you get thrown into the deep end on some of this stuff. And so I get sent out to the airport in Simcoe and told to get on this little Cessna. And the pilot, you know, motions me in. There was no door in the plane. There was no seat in the plane. I'm sitting on the floor with my back to the dash. I'm looking at him like, what's this about? Because I'd flown in planes before, not like this. So anyway, he says, just leave it to me. You know, we'll get you up. We need that door off so you can get a better picture.
Right.
And I'm thinking, I hope I live through this.
Seatbelt holding you in.
So he goes up and he banks, and I'm looking straight at the ground. He says, don't worry, the G-forces will hold you in. And he was right. I mean, as we flew over that area, I could not believe, that was nothing compared to the devastation we saw. It was just so, there were entire farms that were just gone, right? Just leveled. There were a couple fatalities. It was a really sad event. But going back to these guys,
what kind of swath of destruction did that cause from that? Now, 1979. That, if I recall, that one hit Woodstock, and then did it end up coming down through Woodstock, or did it start there and then just go south?
Well, the main hit was at Woodstock, so most of the damage, that city was really hit. And then it just seemed to follow and picked off a number of villages on the way down, right? And so it hit Vanessa and sort of went down to Waterford, did a fair amount of damage in the town of Waterford, right? But then it kind of fizzled out after that. But anyway, these guys sitting there thought, this has some makings of a blues number, so we'll put some words to it.
How many guys got credit for a co-write on that?
Just three other guys and me.
That is fantastic.
But it was
Blue
funny.
Mold Blues. Anyway. Let's spin that one on CKMS Radio and let our listeners hear some original work from Tom. Thanks again, Tom, for doing this. We will be right back with Tom Noon to pick up this conversation just after we listen to Blue Mold Blues. Enjoy.
I got the blue mold blues, I got nothing left to lose. Crops all rotted away, and I got bills that I can't pay, and my banker told me he's got bad news. I got the blue mold blues, my wife just hit the booze. My insurance agent just left town, and my priming gang's just hanging around, saying they've got a deal I can't refuse. Well, I primed one kill just for fun, and I think I'll prime another one. Tobacco, it just turns out black, but if I use a little knack, this year I'll be lucky to harvest a ton. I got the blue mold blues, and every farmer has to pay his dues. But the farm's all gone to pot, now my bank account is shot, and that, my friends, is the good news. I've got 10 pieces of advice, though I think that's awfully nice, except no one can agree. And although it is all free, I'm afraid I'm the one who'll pay the price. I got the blue mold blues, I said I've nothing left to lose. When the tornado started to blow, I joined my wife putting on a glow. I got the blue mold tornado, upside down and dirty bankrupt blues.
Visiting this morning with Rick Weinstein here on CKMS Radio 102.7. Rick Weinstein is a volunteer in our community, and we are a volunteer community radio station driven by volunteers here in this community. And Rick Weinstein stands out. He is very active in our community, and we are pleased to have him in our studios this morning to talk about his involvement with the Kitchener Ranger organization, with the Kitchener Sports Association, and his contributions to that organization and funding our charity organizations in this community. And it was just announced in the last couple of weeks, Rick, that Kitchener Sports Association has donated $100,000 in relief to this COVID-19 program. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and your involvement in it?
Yeah, sure, Paul. Thanks. Thanks for having me on and talking about it. It's the Kitchener Sports Association we're talking about. And I've been a member for well over 30 years. It's a volunteer organization that raises money mainly for minor sports in our community, not-for-profit community groups, and we have a scholarship program as well. Our main source of funding is at Kitchener Ranger Games and Kitchener Waterloo Titans Games, where we have the privilege of running the 50-50 draw. I've been involved with the draw almost 30 years and have been actually the coordinator of that draw for over 25 years now. So it's a great way to make some money in the community and have a lot of fun while we're doing it. So with the funds are taken through the Kitchener Sports Association and handed out through grants and through different avenues through a criteria that we have set up. So what the KSA has done, and we do very well at the Ranger Games. They're very good partners, one thing that we should note is that this isn't a Kitchener Ranger draw; it's a Kitchener Sports Association draw. So there's no money that goes back to the Rangers in any form or at any level. So this is
terrific.
This is a draw that creates revenue for our community, and 100% of the revenue goes back into the community. So we're pretty proud of that,
and 100% supported by the community.
Absolutely.
And just recently, that $100,000 that was allocated to the COVID relief, I believe, $60,000 of it has been allocated already. Tell us where that money's going. And we all know it's supporting this community, and we congratulate your organization for that. But tell us where that is going and how you're helping the community in such a great way at the time that we need it the most.
Oh, for sure, Paul. I mean, it was money that we've got, and it was really kind of a rainy day fund. And, you know, we all said it's pouring out right now, so let's use this money up. So what we did, we basically took a list. Our directors, we had a meeting, took a list of probably about 30 organizations that we thought were in need, and we whittled it down to about 9. And the main ones that we thought were in the most need and that would give the biggest impact for our dollar right now is the food bank was number one on everybody's list, to try and get them as much funding as they can.
You bet.
The House of Friendship and Nutrition for Learning was the other two that we gave out $10,000 each to at the time.
Terrific.
The other ones. Yeah, then we split $30,000 between the YWCA, One Roof, Nutrition for Learning, Wilmot Recreation, Woolwich Resources, and the El Salma House. So we tried to spread that out a little bit, and we held back $40,000 a couple of weeks ago just to kind of see where this whole thing was going to shake out and who was going to probably need the most funding in a couple of weeks. You know, you don't know what you don't know, what was
right.
Going to happen with this pandemic. So
sure.
We waited 2 weeks and met last, I think, Wednesday night to make a decision. It was, a lot of discussion on what to do with $40,000. And at the end of the day, we all felt that the best place to put it would be right back into the to food bank. So we're making an additional $40,000 contribution to the food bank this week. I think we're going to present the check to Wendy Campbell next week. So So that's 100,000. And the beauty of the food bank is that they really take care of a lot of the organizations that we considered giving money to and have given money to. So, mm-hmm. like I said, there's such a need right now, and the fund was really set up to provide food and shelter during the COVID crisis. So we're very proud of that. It's something that we're just so happy that we've been able to do. And unfortunately, in this environment, $100,000 is probably a drop in the bucket, but it's big for us and it's big for our community. And like I said, the group of people we have on this board are just amazing people. President John Thompson, who leads this group, and it's a name that's very well known in the community, and we're fortunate to have John as our president, and just some really, really great names, and I'm pretty proud to be part of it. So that's kind of what we've been up to, and again, biggest thanks, and some of the biggest thanks go to the Kitchener Rangers, who give us the audience to sell our tickets to. The city of Kitchener, who support us, we're in their building all the time, and they give us a few perks to help us do what we do on a volunteer basis. And like I said, I have a group of probably 20, 25 sellers that come to every game and sell tickets on a volunteer basis.
Yeah, you've got a wonderful staff working there on a Friday night, Sunday afternoon. It's a hockey night in Kitchener on Friday nights, and you're a staple with your cast there on Friday nights. And whenever the Rangers hit the ice, selling tickets, and that's the community helping the community. And with the organization that you're a part of is quite an asset to this community. And we all congratulate you for that.
Oh, thanks, Paul. And, I keep going back to the volunteers, and, we call it the second biggest game at the odd, for people to buy tickets, and people line up, they love buying the tickets. They love supporting it, but it's so important to know. I think that it's a Kitchener Sports Association oriented draw, and that the monies are really handed out through there, and the money does not go to the Kitchener Rangers. And a lot of people, have that mentality that it may go back to support the Rangers, and it doesn't. The Rangers give us total control of every dime that comes in, and like I said, it's with the exception of the costs of our license and the cost of our of our electronic system, it's 100% put back into the community. And somebody walks away with a nice check every Friday night.
Every Friday night, a big smile on somebody's face locally. And wow. No, we do. For my listening audience, Rick Weinstein and I go back a long, long way. And there's never been a time, Rick, that I don't remember you being active in our community and giving time wherever you can. So let's hope that we can get back on the ice at the auditorium here shortly and start playing the games that support this community, and put the money in your hands and your group's hands to allocate back into our charity organizations and help this community. And for that and your work for many, many years, it has to be commended, and we congratulate you again for that.
Well, thanks, Paul. It's a really feel-good scenario. I miss my guys. I miss my volunteers. Yeah. I miss my Friday nights at the odd. And, we're back and forth on email through this whole thing, and everybody's anxious to get back at it and, continue raising some money for this community. So, thank you for having me on, and thanks for sharing this great news with everybody. And, we'll keep doing what we do.
This is a community story, and an organization that's been around a long time, helping wherever they can. And I know this community is indebted to the people that donate so many hours of their time and have their hearts in the right direction. And to your organization, to you, Rick, we congratulate you again, and keep up the good work. We can't wait to get back on the ice and see you there at the auditorium, doing what you do best, and having fun, and supporting the community the way you do. So thanks for joining us here on CKMS Radio this morning, and all the best in the future. Stay healthy. We wish you and your family all the best.
Thanks, Paul. Appreciate it. See you soon, buddy.
I'm Jacob Beck from Kitchener, Ontario, and you're listening to 102.7 CKMS Radio Waterloo.ca.
All right, we're back after Blue Mold Blues, Tom's original work. Terrific. Always a pleasure to hear original music in its raw form. What direction is music taking you these days, Tom?
Well, actually, it's funny. All of our kids play. Like, we have three boys. They all play. And so we sit around, and it can be anything from, you know, I went to see Tim Baker, a really well-known musician in Guelph just recently. And so I go to a lot of concerts. With our next door neighbor's a great guitar player, and so he's influenced by all kinds of different Peter Katz and people like that. So it's a lot of the stuff I'm hearing is I still play a lot of traditional music, but the stuff I'm hearing is more modern progressive folk. Some of it's rock, some of it's, you know, I listen to all kinds of different music, and I've always done that. So, you know, sometimes the playing, though, it's usually us sitting around and we'll just play whatever strikes us, right? We'll sometimes sit there and play for hours, and it could be everything from something like the Milk Carton Kids to...
way to go.
You know, we've been lucky to be exposed and see these guys so many times that I think we've seen them six times now.
Saw the Milk Carton Kids?
Yeah, we first saw them in Winnipeg at the Winnipeg Folk Festival in 2013 and thought, oh my goodness, these guys are
crazy.
So
that's going back 2013. Yeah. You know, I just got onto these guys maybe about 3 years ago. So they've been around a lot longer. I missed out on a lot. They are a sensational duo for sure.
They really are. So we've seen them in Buffalo. We've seen them at Hillside in Guelph. Like, we go out of our way. We've always done this. I did this when Stan Rogers was around, and Garnet Rogers. I've gone to see him everywhere. And once the musician sort of hits us, it's like, my wife and I.
You're locked in.
Yeah, we're locked in. And in fact, you know, our sons have taken me to concerts. Our middle son is a great guitar player, so he's taken me to see Bruce Coburn. He had just bought me tickets to see Lyle Lovett and John Hyatt at the Center in the Square, but unfortunately that one's canceled. But it's like we're always talking back and forth about, have you heard this, have you heard that? And they keep throwing music at me that is now... And I love it, right? These are guys who are influenced, you know, and our kids are influenced by all kinds of music. So, I mean, when they were growing up, I mean, they've learned how to play everything like Clapton and Hendrix and all this old stuff. But they also know how to play very current music. And that's what I get a kick out of. You know, we'll sit down and play Sam Roberts or, you know, whatever strikes them. I took them at one point when there was the last big scare with SARS stock. I took our boys to see the lineup that day, and they thought Tea Party was going to be the big one. And so when Guess Who hit the stage, it was interesting to see their reaction, right? So there was Guess Who, there was Rush, and you know, the Stones and AC/DC. And I mean, I love taking them to something like that where there's this entire spectrum of music. And that's how I grew up, and that's how they've kind of grown up. And they'll just pick up an instrument, and if something strikes them, that, you know, they all play different things. So,
well, great influence that you had on your three boys to turn them on to music.
Yeah, and it goes back to my dad and my grandfather and all those guys that played fiddle. And, you know, it's just the same thing, right? We're always just listening to music and coming up with ideas.
Yeah. What you just mentioned Stan Rogers, and I you mentioned Garnet Rogers, and their music hits me. I've been a fan of Stan Rogers for a long time. Never saw him live. Give our listening audience the pleasure of your experience with Stan Rogers. I know a lot of our listeners love his work.
Well, again, it was complete luck. I was at orientation week at Western in 1975.
Wow.
And my wife now, we had just started dating in 1975. She was a master's student in Hamilton, but was at Western with me that day. And she came running in to get me out of a lineup to say, you've got to hear these guys, right? Mm-hmm. And they had just recorded, they were just they had one album out or just coming out at that time. And so we went out and they literally blew me away. I just thought the energy of these guys, and these were all Stan songs, right? They were mainly about the East Coast at this point. But then he goes on, and I think we saw him probably him and that band over a dozen times here. Wow. And also when we lived in Saskatchewan, we also would seek him out. And so we moved out there in 1980, and he died in 1983. But he would play these Western tours, and he wrote an entire album about the Great Lakes, an entire album about the West called Northwest Passage. And he had these great songs that, they're known around the world. And we were also at the Winnipeg Folk Festival the year he died in a plane accident in Cincinnati, and we were there just a couple months later, very short time later in Winnipeg, and the emotion there was outstanding, like just unbelievable. The next year was 1984. Garnet Rogers played there. And if you can imagine, like 15,000 people singing the Mary Ellen Carter together, there wasn't a dry eye in that field there as we were watching this.
Yeah.
And then we were lucky a few years back to see Nathan Rogers, Stan's son, did an entire set of Stan's songs at the Winnipeg Folk Festival, and it sent chills up our spines. We could not believe how good he could perform his father's music, but he also has his own music, which is also phenomenal, right? But anyway, Stan and Garnet were the pinnacle for me in folk music at the time. And the funniest story was, my wife she went to London eventually to go to Fanshawe, get a lab tech diploma, and she ended up living right up the street from where Stan and Willie P. Bennett lived. Oh my gosh, the stories out of those guys, and they would tell this, and at that time in London, they were just barely getting enough money to, put food on their table. And they would often tell the story about, Stan would say, I lived in Willie's closet, or if it was Willie playing, he'd say, I lived in Stan's closet. And it was hilarious. Like, they were both such great songwriters. And, just to see somebody like that. So we've always done that. If we see somebody we really love, we'll go wherever we have to.
I understand that totally. I must have followed John Prine around every damn state and province in Canada. But I know exactly what you're talking about. And I understand totally that once you get hooked on Stan Rogers, Garnet Rogers, you are a Rogers fan. That is for sure. I remember just this past winter, actually back in January, just a few months ago, I was down in Central America, and I got talking to a guy from Halifax, a gentleman from Halifax, and we got talking about Stan Rogers music. And I just happened to be traveling with my guitar, and he asked me at a bar to pull it out and sing him White Squall. He had stories of Stan Rogers growing up in the East Coast, and we sat there over a couple of libations and just talked about his experience, my experience with Stan Rogers and Garnet Rogers. Great talents. You would have thought they lived in the East Coast, but they were just raised just a couple of miles away from where we sit right now here in Kitchener, Hamilton, Ontario.
Yeah, exactly. And Garnet has a great book called Night Drive on the whole experience. It's a very big book to read, but I've actually bumped into him in Hamilton, just walking down the street one day, and had a great chat. Like, I said, "Oh, Garnet," and he didn't recognize me, of course, but I said, "Garnet, I've seen you guys so many times since 1975 and I said, we have a mutual friend, Rob Reed, who's a great arts writer, and Rob has written a lot about Garnet. And so that just led to a half an hour chat on the street in Hamilton. Like, he just spent, it was so great to just chat to him. And he was curious about where we first saw them and stuff, and I told him about being at Western and everything. He said, "Oh my gosh, I remember that." And they had quite he's a really great musician himself. He's just so phenomenal. Like, I thought, here's a chance to actually talk to him, offstage, and there's no pressure. And we're just visiting, right, as friends.
Yeah. I had a great experience with Garnet one time. I got to know him a little bit, and we found out that he was doing a concert. I think it was, and this might ring a few bells for you, down in London at Annie and Carl Grindstaff's house.
Oh, right, okay.
And Annie, I believe it is Annie and Carl, they owned Snail's right. Pace in
yes.
London, the... you know, the notorious folk club, you know, in southwestern Ontario, that was the place to play in London, Smales Pace. And Garnet was doing a concert in December, I think it was 98, and invited us down. We got down to Carl and Annie's house a lot early, sat in their kitchen with Garnet, went through memorabilia in photo albums.
Right.
And just the old days of folk music. And about a year later, I was talking to Garnet. He was doing a concert in Brantford. And unfortunately, we recalled that afternoon. And unfortunately, in that previous 12 months, their home on in London anyway, Commissioners, out by Commissioners Road there, had burnt down to the ground and taken a lot of folk memorabilia with it. It was a pretty unfortunate thing.
Literally, yeah.
But there's a name.
So many people. So
go ahead,
many
yeah.
people played there. I mean, I saw David Wiffen there, Ray Materick. You know, there were all kinds of Canadian folk players. And
the
place to play in London. One of the places for sure, because it had a really good following. And you know, Stan and those guys, Garnet, have obviously played there. It was just a hot club to be in London. And London was, you know, there were. It's kind of like this area. There are so many musicians around there, and a really lively community, right? So,
you bet. Tell me a little bit about growing up in a musical family. I know that you, Darren Schott, you had mentioned the Schotts earlier,
yes.
And anybody that's connected to folk music in southwestern Ontario knows the
yes.
Schotts.
Now, Darren's another guy. Like, we grew up a couple miles apart on the same road. And I remember the day he walked down the stairs at his dad's place. He's 10 years old. He has a mandolin, and he says, "Can I pick with you guys?" And it was his older brother and I were sitting there. And I thought, oh, okay, sure. And away he goes, right? He's already playing Bill Monroe, David Grisman, Sam Bushlicks, like it's nothing. And here he is.
Yeah, at 10 years old.
Right? So, you know, he ended up joining the Good Brothers at 17, and he played everything, like guitar and fiddle, and he toured with them for about 6 or 7 years, and he can play almost anything. He's been playing with Claire Lynch, who's a Nashville singer songwriter who is now living in Toronto, but he's part of her Canadian band here. And oh my gosh, to see those guys as a unit, there's Shane Cook on fiddle, Darren, the story with Darren, they played Banjo Fest in Guelph last year. And Claire said, "Well, that's great, but we don't have a banjo player." So Darren said, "Oh, I'll figure it out." So he borrowed his brother's banjo, and he learned it in a month. Anyway, we're sitting there at this thing in Guelph, you know, and that band is playing, and there's about half a dozen great banjo players who are all buddies of ours. And they're all sitting there with their mouths open as he whips out these banjo tunes like you wouldn't believe, right? And that's his head. Like, he just learned. Well, he'll sit down and learn it. So a little further up the road where we grew up were the Crothers family, and that was Bill and Dave Crothers. Bill and Dave played with Marie Bottrell and Terry Sumption, and oh my gosh, they. And Bill, Dave passed and I flew back for the funeral when I was in the West, flew back for it. But then Bill went on, and he was Country Drummer of the Year in Canada for 3 years straight
yeah.
in South Mountain.
Wow.
South Mountain, I think all of those were. And then he managed bands, and he ended up booking. He was a booking agent for Casinorama for years. So he had so many great stories about people, right? Everybody from Ringo Starr down, you know, the Oak Ridge Boys, and you name it, all these musicians that played Casinorama, he knew them.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, they'd sit down and had visits with them and phone calls, and, you know, they'd show up and there'd be a party or whatever. And he was just a real
wow.
character. He passed away a couple of years ago, and, you know, big loss, I mean, for all of us.
Yeah, I remember the day.
Yeah.
A friend of mine, Dale Bilton, knew yes. Bill, and I met Bill a couple of times. I had no idea he was connected to the Casinorama, and until now, but... yeah, he was a great drummer and a super guy. Always had a smile on his face, and that's news to me. I didn't know that he was a Norfolk County musician from around that area.